As leader of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s, Dr. Martin Luther King changed the history of this country. The impact of his courage and actions were felt throughout the world. Today, Pennsylvanians whose lives were touched by Dr. King remember the young seminary student who was to become one of this century's greatest heroes.
I think the major thing I remember about Martin as a student in my classes was his deep concentration on what was being said and his penetrating questions. King was always waiting for me when I came to class, and he was always dressed in a suit, white shirt, and a tie, and his shoes were shiny. And it took him a long time to loosen up. During his senior year, he was elected president of student body, first black president of student body ever recruited.
Grand Barber called him just like his son. The most of the young black ministers would come in and go to Crozier. They would always send them to Reverend Barber, because Reverend Barber had got his divinity degree from over at Crozier. So they would send them to Calvin, and they would practice preaching on us all the time. Well, we enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. He stood tall, but he was not tall. And when he spoke, I mean, these walls vibrated just because of his speech. I was young, and I'll never forget it.
He was so full of life. I had never before known anybody that alive. And he was as turned on about religious ideas and philosophy as people are about prize fights. And the discussions that he and my father would have were just absolutely enthralling. I used to just sit and listen.
Quiet. Maybe some thought he was aloof in the beginning, but once a topic was introduced that was dear to his heart, and that was about equality. He was always about all mankind. He wasn't just concerned about black people. Mm-hmm. He was concerned about all people.
When he came to Crozier, he was a biblical literalist. He believed the Bible word for word. When he left Crozier, he could no longer believe that. So it sort of shook him up. And a lot of other things that he learned at Crozier shook him up, and he reoriented his old pattern of thinking theologically as a result of the experience at Crozier.
So a lot of things happened to Martin Luther King in this town. He learned how to preach here. He became a mature, serious person in Chester and in this church.
This is a man who is ready to live a life with a congregation that is well-ordered, that is middle class by Afro-American standards, and yet puts all of that aside in order to confront the worst forms of social injustice that this country has been able to throw at any group of people, and to confront these things that were life-threatening on an hourly, not even a monthly basis. And to inspire similar courage in masses of people to walk into the mouth of the lion, into the face of death, singing with nothing but a song. We shall overcome, or just like a tree planted by the waters, we shall not be moved.
For more than 12 months now, We, the Negro citizens of Montgomery, have been engaged in a nonviolent protest against injustices and indignities experienced on city buses. We came to see that in the long run, it is more honorable to walk in dignity than ride in humiliation.
He had my father to come down and do a week's service there, religious education, what they called it, at the height of the boycott. So, and they used to have these arguments about nonviolence all the time because my father said nonviolence was the tool of a majority. It was not a tool of a minority. And he said, and we blacks are a minority in this country. They didn't say blacks and they said the Negro. So he said, I don't know how you're going to do it. And Mike would say, because it's not going to be based upon blacks. It's going to be based upon people of goodwill. I'm appealing to the conscience of America. And my father said, ah, oh, that's the question. Does America have a conscience? We don't know.
He set out to write a book that would reach the people and explain to them what this was all about. He didn't want it to be a book like a PhD dissertation. He wanted it to be a popular book. And he asked me to help him on the chapter on nonviolence, his chapter, Pilgrimage to Nonviolence. He drew on ideas from the Bible, from other ministers, from Gandhi, from Thoreau, from others. But what came out in the end was not a patchwork. It was a tapestry. It was his weaving, intensely so.
I believe that Martin Luther King wanted to come to India because of wanting to see the places that had been significant in the life of Gandhi, to, in a sense, embark on a pilgrimage, one might say, to not the holy places, but to significant places. And then certainly he also wanted to have an opportunity to talk and confer with those who had been close to Gandhi and had taken part in the independence struggle. And I remember that Coretta spoke about the fact one evening that both she and Martin realized that someday he would probably be assassinated. The attempt had been made on his life already. Of course, also their home had been bombed already. Then she said that it was his faith, and the doctor had said that it was the serenity, really, of Martin when that paper cutter had come so close to his heart, and his quiet confidence in the presence of God that had brought him through.
We organized Philadelphia to march, participate, because we were competing with other cities to see who could get the most people in the march.
I had a fellow coming from a bus set up, and I said, can you get me some buses? He said, yes, I can get you some buses. And he said, you have to put a deposit down. I said, all right. So about 12 o'clock, he comes, I got the 75 Greyhounds. I said, I'll take them. And in the afternoon, I got 25, and I'll take them and so forth. And I sold 500 busloads from Philadelphia. And a train load, I had to get the Pennsylvania Railroad to make up a train. They took them off the Chestnut Hill to make up a train. So we had 42,000 people that went, the largest contingent in the country was Philadelphia.
With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day.
First time I went to Atlanta with them, there was a place called Funtown. amusement park. And it's like Great Adventure, or a place up here near Harrisburg, where kids go and play. And we were driving from the airport because he had met me. And he pointed it out to me that they couldn't play, and his kids couldn't play, and they were young kids at that time. He said, my kids can't go in there and play, but one day they will be able to go in there. And he's pointed right from the airport, you can see it. He said, it's called Funtown. And he said, we'll get it. We'll, my kids and other kids afterwards will play in Funtown.
Mike loved America. And it hurt him, you know, when his patriotism was questioned because he had fundamental disagreements with certain policies that he did not feel were really rooted in the democratic dream or in what the founding fathers had envisioned. And he had to oppose those things that he felt did not represent the true character of America.
We are here to see that this march does not continue. You are ordered to stop, stand where you are.
This we marched across the bridge, the Pettus Street Bridge, and from Selma on our way to Montgomery. Wallace and the Alabama State Police stopped the march from going, and we returned back. And he didn't advocate any violence toward anybody, but as we marched through the city of Selma, the people, the residents was out there, and they was calling us names, and the kids was making all kind of racial remarks, you know. It was like I was more frightened there than I was in Vietnam, over there when I went over there. And he prayed for those people and the governor. And I thought that was kind of unusual. When most of us wanted to take a stick or a baseball bat, he was praying for them to forgive them for their sins.
On that march, you had federal helicopters hovering overhead to protect the marchers. You had federal National Guardsmen on the side. Lyndon Johnson had just gone to Congress, and his words were ringing, "We shall overcome," the battle cry of the civil rights movement. And there was truly a meeting of the protest movement and public power. And that's what we've been waiting for, because if you didn't have the response of government and public power and Congress and the president and just the protest, it would be one hand clapping. And that was the moment that I knew that the two had come together.
SCLC would have these projects, and it cost a lot of money. People think it just happened out of the sky, but it didn't. And the American Friends Service Committee was a big donor, and then some of the churches there were big donors, such as Brighthurst Baptist under Congressman Gray's father, the Reverend William Gray, and also Reverend Shepherd's at Mount Olivet Tabernacle. Any number of churches would raise money for him, so he would come back frequently.
It really was designed to have Dr. King to come face to face with people in the community who were struggling with their problems day to day, organized groups and individuals. And then in that particular neighborhood where the rally was being held, we had one at 40th and Lancaster, we had one at 17th and Columbia, we had one at 22nd and Columbia. There would be a home of a person who was the head of an organization, or at least was actively engaged in community work, where he would go into the home and sit and talk with people.
We scheduled him to go places where he wouldn't normally go. We went to the projects, the housing projects, and where there were massive numbers of African Americans, and we just wanted them to see these people, and they wanted to see him. That's why you have such crowds as you have, because they had never seen him, and they came out in mass numbers.
I welcomed him to my home, and what I was impressed most about, he was so calm. Even though we had a very emotional situation going on in Philadelphia at that time, he was so calm, and in that black silk suit and that white shirt and black tie looked as though he hadn't sat down in it, you know. He was just so pressed, I guess you can say. And his hands were nice and soft. And I looked at his face and I thought to myself, he's so calm. You know, and it seemed as though that he had just, was it just determined that he was going to do what he had to do.
Took him up to Girard College with Cecil B. Moore and some of the other local leaders, because at that time we were demonstrating at Girard College to integrate it. And we walked all the way around the college walls, and we walked and he spoke and he encouraged the people to continue the demonstration until the walls came down. And they did.
We're here at Baptist Temple, and Baptist Temple is on Temple's campus, Temple University's campus, and this is where we had the culminating event of this visit here in Philadelphia. There were 10,000 by the count of the police. And since police usually count a little less than there are, we're going to assume that there were more than 10,000 people here. Men, women, children, black, white, and just everybody imaginable was here to hear Dr. King.
Well, on his last visit, he spent that Friday at St. Thomas Episcopal Church at 52nd and Parish Streets in Philadelphia, talking to various black community groups. But he was coming down with the virus. He was supposed to come back on Saturday to see the rest of the community, and he had to cancel. So he called to tell me he couldn't make it. He was not well, and he was going to go. He had an appointment at the American Friends Service Committee, and he was going to keep that, and then he left.
The news came at 6:10. I know the time. I was working right here at the station. And my person was answering the phones. Came at 7 minutes of six and said King had been shot in Memphis. And I thought it was just an injury. And 2 minutes later, they told me he had died. Things closed down. Everything in the black community closed down. People took to the streets. And we were out in the streets telling people that it wouldn't, you know, benefit to do anything that would mar the name of Martin Luther King. That was the mood was sad and anger and the loss, we felt we'd lost the leader that we needed. It was a sad time in black America when he passed on.
In his first conversation with me, when he said it, don't focus on the death, but how much we can do while we're alive. It's just, think of what he did. In a dozen years, he changed the history of this country.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty! We are free at last!
The only weapon that he had to struggle with was the United States Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. So he took that and wrapped himself around that, and that was his standard. That was his battle axe in the time of a battle, and shelter in the time of a stone.
He's got the whole world.
I think he gave the masses, regardless of color, a sense of hope, not only in America, but in the world.
He's got the wind and the rain.
He's like no other man that I've met in my lifetime, to me. He was just not no other person I've met like him. He was kind of like, to me, like sainthood, saintly.
Our young people, they need to know there's a little Martin Luther King in each of them. Not to do exactly what he did, but to find out what it is that they have in them to do. And to realize that, as King showed, somebody didn't set out to do it. You can do great things. As he said, everybody can be great because everybody can serve.
I just hope we can keep the dream alive, even though the King is dead.
Mm-hmm. God bless.